I think if he was here, he might clarify and say, that's great, but I'm kind of really talking about these massive, mm-hmm. beautiful 800-year-old trees. And, yes. and I think in a couple cases, his point was, yeah. I could not put my chainsaw into that
yeah,
tree.
Yeah, he said I couldn't dip the bar of my saw into the Dorner tree.
And you
yeah.
probably would not disagree necessarily with that. All right, welcome to another episode of the Essential Craftsman podcast. I'm Nate. I've got my dad, Scott, here, who's the Essential Craftsman. We have what will be our first installment of our book review discussion book club podcast.
Yeah, that's fair.
And the idea is we both want to read more. And well,
have read more in the past, but for the most yeah. recent history, not so much.
You probably never stopped reading.
I have for the past 5 or 6 years. It just kind of came to a stop, but for a long time I didn't stop. Yeah.
Well, I haven't read much over the last few years. A couple books, maybe one book per year, and we want to do better, and we're starting now, and we've got a book to discuss today, and we're going to tell you our next two books in the installment, so in case you want to also read with us, you can. And we're going to be talking about the book by Larry Hahn, A Carpenter's Life, As Told by Houses. Do you want to give a little background about Larry Hahn before we kind of start? Just in case you don't know. I feel like he comes up every single podcast
these days. He comes up a lot,
but,
and I don't know if that's a plus or a minus. But
yeah, we'll get away from it eventually.
Yeah, but he has been really intriguing because he sort of broke the ground in the 20th century as far as bringing production framing into a, if not a mainstream platform, at least making production framing techniques as developed in Southern California, you know, from 1948 through the 60s, with he and his brothers right on the cutting edge of that. And so he had presence of mind or capacity or time or success enough to sit down and write about these framing techniques. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of interesting comparing his book, The Very Efficient Carpenter, Basic Framing for Residential Construction, which is where he kind of made his entrance, I think, into the world of writing a little bit. And then he was a contributing editor for Fine Home Building for a long time. He wrote editorials and articles. And then this must be his last thing, probably, A Carpenter's Life as Told by Houses.
So is he the most well-known then for the Very Efficient Carpenter book?
I would say so. I've got a good friend, although our paths have diverged for the past 30 years, Mark Clayton, taught in the union apprenticeship program down in the Bay Area. And Mark told me about this, you know, 38 years ago when we were both new carpenters and he was kind of going the union route and I started out the non-union route. And he said, man, there's this book and this old guy really knows his stuff. And sure enough, he did.
Yeah. And this book, which is not what we're going to be discussing, is very textbook-like. There's diagrams, there's pictures, explanations, photographs, and it's very much textbook
How to,
yeah.
Completely different than this book.
The book that we both read is his memoir that he wrote towards the end of his life, and he kind of talks about his life as told through houses is how he laid it out. I didn't know much about Larry Hahn. In fact, all I really knew was what I made up about him while I was watching videos of him working with his brother. So, in other words, nothing. But he kind of walks, he starts at the beginning with his mom, who grew up in a sod house in Nebraska, and then kind of goes through all the different types of homes that he built and lived in
and was aware of, and that he had neighbors who lived in.
Yeah.
I mean, he contrasts sod houses, which are houses built out of turves of sod cut out of the prairie and stacked up, with dugouts, which are caves dug down into the prairie on the you know, the leeward side of a rise, dig it in, roof it with whatever you can, and hunker down to try to survive the winter.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he had a lot to say about that and some non-conventional building techniques and Habitat for Humanity, which it sounds like kind of dominated his last years, you know, on the earth. He's immersed himself in that, I think.
Well, he donated a lot of his time and effort and energy and expertise to building and charitable work, and for him, Habitat for Humanity was the at least one of the places. So he, in other words, he built homes his whole career, and then he built them for free in his retirement.
Yeah, how about that?
In terms of the house styles that stood out, the one that was really interesting to me was about straw houses. Did you know anything about that, or you have anything to add from what you learned?
You know, just articles I've read on straw houses in the Mother Earth News over the years. he spoke about straw houses that were somehow code compliant, you know, put on some sort of a foundation with a hold down system and dead man sort of bolted, you know, lumber that was attached to the straw so you could attach a roof system. I have always had problems with my eyes rolling back in my head when you talk about straw houses, right? That has not made any sense to me. But I mean, there it is. You're creating habitat for bugs, certainly. There's something to be said for that.
I don't know. I had the opposite thought. To me, it made a ton of sense, this natural material that is super insulating, anybody can build with. And I can't even remember if this is how he described those buildings, but if you think about a timber frame, you build the structure and then fill it up with
something,
straw. Am I remembering correctly that he did discuss those as homes that are being built nowadays?
Yeah, I think he got involved with building one of those in the Northwest when he came up here or something. But he had some hands-on, as with a Cobb house. Now, I had never heard of a Cobb house.
Explain that for the viewer.
As I got it from Larry's sort of description, you mix mud in vats, much like you'd be mixing mortar, and place it in sort of light-duty forms that follow the construction of the walls on up. You can't go too high because it takes a long time for it to dry, and until it dries, it'll just slump under the increasing weight of the wall. But you can kind of free-form it in and out and put your plumbing and your wiring and your electrical in the mud walls as you come on up, and then cast some dead man, I think, like a plate at the top with some pieces of all thread or something down into the mud to hold it for fastening your roof system to. I'd never heard of it, but I can see that. I mean, from a certain perspective, if you could keep that dry, that makes more sense to me than straw, which is so biodegradable, right?
Yeah. What parts of the book surprised you, or what did you not expect in reading this?
I didn't expect the grittiness of his upbringing on the Nebraska High Plains, but he's older than my dad. He's a full generation, almost two, in front of me. Mm-hmm. And so he came through the Great Depression, and just talking about the hard scrabble, that was one of his words, existence that they lived, and how contented they were with very little, but how tired he got of always being cold.
Yeah.
You know, talking about that bathing was a big thing because water was not readily available and heat was not available, and so to heat water, and so just talking about the reality of life without windows, life without real doors, where running and walking were his only means of transportation, didn't have a bicycle as a kid, and yet how he looked back on his childhood with fondness. His mom's baked bread made a huge impact, and he remained a sucker for homemade bread his whole life. That was interesting.
I was, like, anytime you read an historical account of someone living in a more difficult setting, it's really eye-opening, and he talked about in Nebraska the cold and how common it kind of was. You know, people died in the cold. If you get locked out, if you get lost, if one of those whiteout blizzards come, people and children,
livestock
die.
Yeah.
And man, that is just so removed from my life. And yet for him, it was
standard. You remember that story about somebody that froze in a whiteout and they had to build fires to thaw the ground to get down through the frozen soil enough to bury the people? That's hard times, man.
And another story that I almost can't bring myself to repeat, but a big blizzard happened in the middle of the day, and half of the school kids decided to try to walk home. These are elementary school kids, and of course, never made it.
Didn't make it.
And so half the town lost children in this blizzard, and it was known as the children's blizzard.
The children's blizzard of whatever year it was.
And just
think of that.
And it's unfathomable.
It is, the loss.
It's not that loss is unfathomable, but for something like cold or snow in where we live and how we live, man, that would be
the last thing
painful.
You would think of as a threat, you know, on the High Plains in earlier times was a dire threat.
Yeah, really amazing. Okay, a couple other things that were interesting. Larry described gas and wax. Do you want to let the viewers know what that is? Because that's a term that might be used occasionally, and why don't you kind of explain that?
So first of all, I've got all the respect in the world for Larry Hahn. You know, for Larry Hahn is iconic, and I love what he said about that production techniques do not necessarily mean a reduction in quality. In fact, usually they mean that quality becomes more predictable and more dependable.
And it means that the products become more affordable.
More affordable, and the quality goes up within the context of building codes and inspections and competition. But he was clear that he didn't see any downside to gas and waxing nails, because nails are almost always contributing strength because of shear and not resistance to draw out. So the criticism I've always heard about gas and wax.
Hang on one sec. Explain that for a minute. You know, nails used to be more valuable. They're kind of not a big deal.
Okay.
What was gas and wax, and what does that mean?
Okay, so he was talking about nails, common nails and box nails, and the different types of nails that would be included in building a house, especially when the cuts were made with a handsaw and all the nails were put in by hand, usually with just a light 16-ounce hammer in an earlier carpentry sort of method. And so coming out of that, they began to be frustrated with having to put in box nails and how it was just hard to put them in.
Yeah.
You know, with tap set or tap set, you know, tap drive set. And so a standard practice became to dissolve some wax, some paraffin. I forget what he said the amount was. I've heard of it being like a couple pounds of wax in a couple gallons of gas. And then you would dump a keg of nails, 16-penny nails.
So the wax would dissolve into the gas.
Yeah, you would dissolve it in the gas. He mentioned the gas, it worked better if the gas was a little warm. Warm the gas up a little bit. Mm-hmm. However you do that, dissolve the paraffin in there, drop a keg of nails into a metal bucket, and then pour this gas holding the wax over, saturate, float, if you want, the nails in this paraffin-carrying wax. And then he didn't speak to this. I think he just maybe poured it off later and let the nails dry. But some guys would burn off the gas.
Yeah.
So now you had soot and wax coating the nails. At the end of the day, you were covered with black. But the apocryphal wisdom was you could push those nails in with your thumb because they were so lubricated by wax.
What was the term he used? A single blow or a single whack? How did he describe one hit?
Oh, a lick. I think he just said.
Yeah, one lick.
One lick. One lick. Yeah, and they go.
That okay. was the metric he used for if someone's good. You could get the nail in with one lick.
Yep. Now, that was not one lick. That was a tap to set it and a lick to drive it in. You know, it's really hard to hit that nail hard enough to drive it in without starting it.
Yeah.
I've never been able to do that. But they were making money, right? If you would gas and wax your nails, they would go in. And the faster you could put them in, the more money you made. He talked about other contrivances, a cart that you could sit on and wheel yourself around with the nails on the cart. So you could sit on this little cart and nail off subfloor by hand.
Yeah. All of this is before nail guns, obviously.
Yeah.
So anyways, he had an inspector who criticized him for gas and wax in his nails, and he stuck up for himself and said, hey, it's not a big deal because the strength of these nails comes in shear.
Yes.
In other words, the nails are not going to shear off because
right.
of gas and wax, so chill out.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, there's truth to that. When the nail's embedded and it's getting its strength because it won't be pushed or pulled sideways, that's shear strength. But shear strength is diminished if the resistance to draw out is diminished also. I mean, if you can grab it with a pair of pliers and just pull it out, and that's an exaggeration. You can't, even if it's gas and waxed. But I mean, good for Larry. He was smart and articulate and was a hired gun, you know, and he could probably hold his own arguing with an inspector.
We had to do some testing on that and see how much easier it is, because now nails come with a little coating of glue, which does the same thing and helps them go in. But
vinyl coated sinkers is what they're called. And it does the same thing. And it allows them to slip in, and it kind of acts like a glue, and they stick a little better.
Yeah. Another story I enjoyed was when the union boss cut off his hammer for being too long. And he said that there was a lot of, he talked about some of the pressure from unions, from other carpenters, as these younger production guys showed up and started just really specializing. That's what he described. He described how in his era in California, people started specializing. And once that happened, boom, things started just like really moving quickly.
And the union was invested in jobs. And so if you get, as productivity goes up, the number of workers is perceived to go down. And so he was in a sort of a face-to-face with the union representative saying, hey, your hammer violates union rules. It's too long. You're moving too fast. And he would cut the handle off, end of his handle off to get it down to the specified length. And that night, Larry would go home and put the extra long handle on there so he could set him with a single lick.
Yeah.
But he also made the point that it didn't take him and his brothers long to realize that there was a certain, what do you say, $90 to frame a house or something?
Yeah.
And that with the old school methods that were being used, it would take a few guys a week or something. But he and his brother started pioneering these techniques to where pretty soon they were doing one in a day. So think of the incentive for those guys to be racehorses, and think of the hard feelings that would be engendered by the people who didn't have their methods.
I really got the feeling reading the book that this was written by a guy who was at the end of his life, an old man. I think, I don't know if he was 80 when he wrote it.
I think he was.
But he really seemed content and pleased and at peace, and he was kind of questioning, you know, why the consumerism of the day is the way it is. But altogether, I was kind of moved by, wow, like the title says, A Carpenter's Life.
Yeah.
And as it turns out, a carpenter can live just a beautiful life and make a huge impact. And at the end of his life, he describes his kids and grandkids and the satisfaction he gets from his gardening. And
so I understand that mindfulness, as I understand it, is a term that sort of is perhaps connected to an Eastern, maybe a Buddhist philosophy. I don't know, but it makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, taking a moment to take a deep breath and enjoy the moment that we have, being the only one. And he talks quite a bit about that. I think it seems to me that he was an appreciator of sort of Eastern philosophy, perhaps, maybe as he got older. But I think he was kind of in tune moment by moment and kind of trying to enjoy the moments of his life.
Yeah, I think so. I wish, the other thing I thought of several times as I read the book was how much I wished he had also written as a younger man, because he was very sentimental and reflective in this. And, you know, like a lot of older men, kind of questioning, like, why is the world the way it is right now? This is not at all the way it was when I was younger. Not that he was saying that. He wasn't writing like, when I was younger, it was better. He was just kind of questioning the consumerism, the need for huge houses.
Yeah.
And I wondered how much that would match some of his energy as a younger man if he were to write about, you know, they built the houses in a day and made $90. He was probably making
bucks.
A lot of money.
Probably 10 times what his peers were making.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I wonder what...
He probably wasn't thinking those thoughts then.
Yeah.
So here's the other thing. He came from the Midwest to California with everything that California culture was sort of developing then. I wonder if he would have had those same sort of concerns or topics on his mind if he would have stayed in the Midwest and worked his life out back there farming or ranching or not seeing that Western United States culture develop.
I don't know. I think he was talking specifically about, as an 80-year-old, seeing people on Facebook and Twitter and iPads, and I think he saw firsthand the world we're living in and was kind of speaking to that, you know, people walking, as he described, walking out of Walmart with a shopping cart, driving to their storage unit next door and putting the stuff in the storage unit. And he's scratching his head saying, maybe we don't actually need all this stuff. Yeah. And he's not wrong.
And then he was completing the loop. And then some period of time later, the storage unit empties out into the landfill.
Yeah.
And why did we need all that stuff that came out of the box store anyway?
Yeah. You
know? Can't argue with that too much, right?
Indeed. And I was certainly impressed and liked his discussion on Habitat. Not his discussion, but like I said, Larry gave back. He helped build these homes for Habitat for Humanity. And I really got a chuckle out of imagining, and there were some photos, so you didn't have to imagine, but it's a lot of probably school teachers and, I don't know, bartenders helping do this. Yeah. And that's great. And he probably kind of looked like some other volunteer, but holy smokes.
It
would have been neat when he walked onto the job and just kind of like, bing, bang, bong, done. Yeah.
just a little bomb went off and the house was built, you know. And here's this old, tall, skinny 80-year-old man up walking the plates, and they're saying, wait, you can't be up there with fall protection. And poof, the roof was on.
Yeah. I read another article of his on that, was it Fine Home Building that he wrote for?
Yeah, he wrote for them a lot.
He just got a lot of things right about the insight of building codes not always benefiting the community or the individuals, because it drives the cost up and that people do need affordable places. He talked about mobile homes here or manufactured homes.
He did.
And he wasn't critical or snooty the way you might expect a carpenter. He was acknowledging, hey, people got to live. These are affordable. They can be built in a factory much quicker than on the site. Mm-hmm. In fact, he described installing one for his parents up in Montana.
Mm-hmm. So here's where Larry and I parted company a little bit. And it's not with the sensitivity that you can hear in his voice about, wow, there's got to be a better way to live than a rat race and consumption and, you know, McMansions. And I can't diverge with him there. But he came to the Pacific Northwest, and he was hugely critical of our logging culture. And he just staked it out firmly that the big trees were all gone, and that the forests were now monoculture, which means that all we're planting is the harvestable trees, the commercially viable stock, primarily Douglas fir. And he rightly pointed out the profoundly diminished salmon runs. I mean, he's right. He is clearly right about that. And that can be attributed to earlier and irresponsible logging practices and overfishing and the sea lions, which have been unreasonably protected by federal law. And they just wipe out huge portions of the salmon run. And so it's a very complex sort of set of dynamics. And he, because I think of coming from California and loving the trees and having cut so much of it up into blocks and nailed it into place, I don't think Larry spent enough time out driving around the hills in Josephine and Coos and Douglas and in the counties and seeing how the forests grow and how what this country does, no matter what we do, is grow timber at an amazing rate.
Yeah.
And, you know, growing up here, hunting here, spending a lot of time in the hills, there are portions of the forest, the natural forest, that are monoculture because that is the type of tree that flourishes on north aspect, not entirely wet. It'll be Douglas fir all the way. And you get around to south aspect and the Douglas fir kind of peters out and ponderosa pine is what you have. And you get down in the lower lands in the savanna and then the madrone and the that he talks about is part of the mix. And so, you know, maybe Larry came with more wisdom than I have, but I feel like having grown up here and being involved in that industry that I wish I could have given him a couple of tours and shown him that my dad and I in our logging on a couple of the jobs were making the third set of stumps, the third set. Now, the first set that was still there were big, 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 big. And the second set were not that big, but the set that we were making were larger in diameter than the second set of stumps. Mm-hmm. And so that is not as catastrophic, and there's not an Armageddon that's been going on with the lumber economy on the West Coast, but rather it's the crop that we grow here, yeah. Or it was before marijuana was legalized in Oregon. Yeah. You know, it was the crop.
Yeah, turns out there's two plants that you really will.
Turns out there's two plants now.
Yeah, that's right. And I think if he was here, he might clarify and say, that's great, but I'm kind of really talking about these massive, mm-hmm. beautiful 800-year-old trees. And,
yes.
And I think in a couple cases, his point was, yeah. I could not put my chainsaw into that
tree.
Yeah,
he said I couldn't dip the bar of my saw into the Dorner tree.
And you
yeah.
probably would not disagree necessarily with that. That's you know, that's almost a different thing than
it is.
Than the truth that timber around here is a renewable resource.
Yeah.
It grows, it's harvested responsibly, planted. You know, we ought to have someone on here who can who's in this industry.
We will.
Even on the just the planning side, because I have a feeling there's It's like you said, it's not Armageddon, and it could even be that the industry and the number of trees in the state is, you know, better than ever.
That's a fact. That is a quantifiable, empirical piece of data that's true. There's more trees growing right now in Oregon than there was, as near as we can tell, when the pioneers got here, but based on their descriptions of the open spaces in Willamette Valley and.
Interesting.
But the biggest trees have been cut.
Yeah.
That's wrong. A lot. Most of the big trees have been turned into a product that we have used.
Yeah.
And there are trees growing so fast. There are trees that are as old as I am that are the diameter of this table. Okay, yeah. Now that doesn't mean it's a remarkably high quality wood, but they're a beautiful tree with old growth characteristics.
Yeah.
There are trees as old as you are that are this diameter right here, and they're growing like crazy. And the earth is doing its job.
Yeah. Yeah. Like George Carlin says, the earth's going to be fine. We're the ones who are screwed.
Yeah, that's right. And that's Larry's point. You know, that's his point.
All right. Well, hopefully we didn't spoil this book. And it's kind of an easy read. It's like an easy, pleasant read. You'll get through it in a couple days. And it will make you enjoy his videos more, getting to know more about the man. We continue to be huge fans, and I can promise you we will take a break. Actually, no. I was going to say we'll take a break from talking about Larry Hahn, but we're going to interview one of his family members, and then we'll take a break from a while and give you guys some new topics.
Yeah, so here's the thing. I wish I would have known him. I wish I could have learned from him, and I wish I could have taught him a few things. Maybe in a blacksmith shop. Maybe with a still 044, you know, putting some of the wood on the ground that's going to be turned into houses for people who need their habitat also. But he was just an uncommon guy. He was a guy that epitomized continuing a lifetime learner, you know, and reconsidering his positions and adjusting his positions as that became clear to him. So way to go, Larry.
And that's not unique to him. I mean, very few people have seen a logging landing or a forest replanted. That's just, and it's like all things, you have to kind of maybe look a little deeper than just the surface level. Great book, A Carpenter's Life as Told by Houses.
And his other books are great too. The Very Efficient Carpenter. This is, in fact, the textbook if you want to be a very efficient carpenter.
Yeah, that probably is just the gold standard, can never really...
Yeah, never. It'll never be improved on.
Yeah, it's the 101. Mm-hmm. All right, well, thanks for tuning in, everybody, and we will catch you next time.
Thanks.